I have a dream.
One small step.
How may we say
God. The wall must go.
Diana, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Tonight's This Week in History begins with a small explosion, which did very little damage. At 10:20 p.m. on September 18th, 1931, a little bit of dynamite was set off on a railway line near the town of Mukden in Manchuria, a part of northeastern China. The explosion was so inconsequential in terms of the damage done that just 5 minutes later, a train successfully passed across the same stretch of track, failing to register that anything had happened. So why are we talking about this tonight? Well, that attack was effectively the beginning of the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, and that invasion of Manchuria, of course, paved the way for the occupation of China, Japan's isolation from the West, and the outbreak of the Pacific War in 1941. Dr. Peter Moak is a senior lecturer in Asian history at the University of Western Sydney. He's with us in This Week in History to tell the story of the Mukden or the Manchuria incident. Hello, Peter. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Hi, Suzanne. Thanks for having me.
Take us back to the night of September 18th. What exactly happened?
More or less, as you explained it, a bunch of a small group of Japanese officers took some dynamite to the tracks. The tracks were part of a Japanese-owned railway in northeastern China. They set the dynamite off, and as you say, the explosion was really not terribly exciting because, as you said, the train passed over this very spot very soon thereafter without any problems whatsoever. But again, as you said, it provided the Japanese with a pretext to fight against the Chinese, which they did, and in a very, very short space of time, they had not only launched an invasion of China's northeastern provinces, but in fact, they were able to effectively lop those northeastern provinces known collectively as Manchuria. They were able to lop that off from China and create what they called an independent state.
So what we haven't quite said here, Peter, was that it was the Japanese itself, wasn't it, who set off the explosion to their own controlled railway lines?
Yes, yes. So very much so. Of course, they blamed the Chinese. Nobody believed them, including anybody in Japan, because this was a Japanese-owned railway track. These officers were part of the Japanese garrison force, which existed to protect the railway track. They were vastly better trained, better armed than were any Chinese forces in the area. And so basically there was no way imaginable that anybody could get anywhere near that track unless they were to allow that person near that track. So I guess, yeah, there were one of two possibilities. Either they let somebody in or they blew it up themselves. But the jury is not out. They certainly did it themselves.
They decided that. All right. So why were there Japanese troops based in Manchuria at this time? Why did they have control of this railway line? Just trying to explain the situation to us.
Mm-hmm. We have to go back a little ways in time to answer that question. The Japanese fought against the Russians in 1904-1905. The Japanese won that war. It began, from the Japanese perspective, as a war to push the Russians out of the Korean Peninsula, which subsequently became a Japanese colony. But once the Japanese had successfully pushed the Russians out of Korea, they then continued to push, and this meant, ultimately, that the battlefields of the Russo-Japanese War were, in fact, Manchuria, so China's northeastern provinces. The Japanese were successful in that war. They won all manner of concessions in that war, or because of that war. Most importantly, they had control of the railway tracks, which crisscrossed Manchuria, and this came with the right to station that garrison force that I'd mentioned before, which existed solely to protect those tracks.
Okay, so you've got Japanese troops on Chinese soil with a Japanese-controlled railway line. That's what's going on here. Mm-hmm. And Japan's got control over the Korean Peninsula.
Yes.
And where's China at politically?
China was a mess. The Qing dynasty had collapsed in 1911-1912. There were efforts at replacing it with, well, certainly with a republic. And there were certainly efforts at creating a strong and viable Chinese government. But by the 1920s, nobody in China really was listening to the central government. And instead, there were, across the provinces, there were strong men or warlords who controlled their own armies. They collected their own taxes. They effectively ran their own little mini states or mini nations. This made it, in fact, easier for the powers like Japan in this instance to kind of muscle in on China, as it were.
All right. Now, was that a formal policy of Japan's at the time to muscle in on China, or was it just that they happened to be controlling this bit of railway, or was it part of a broader, more cohesive push?
Everybody in Japan could agree that Manchuria comprised an area of special interest to Japan. That was beyond question. For example, when, say, Japanese diplomats and so on spoke with, say, American, British counterparts, they would, at some length, they would explain that they would talk about the geographic proximity and so on, and make it very, very clear to their, say, their Western counterparts that certainly Manchuria, so far as Japan was concerned, this was very much an area of special interest.
Why? Did they want its resources, or did they want it as a buffer zone?
All of the above.
Right.
Yes, all of the above. So they saw, well, certainly they coveted the resources. They expected, they hoped and expected to find oil, which didn't really eventuate. They did find some kind of really low-grade coal. They had these images of vast tracts of farming land, which kind of fired the imaginations of some folks. But also, certainly so far as the Japanese army was concerned, Russia or the Soviets were what they called hypothetical enemy number one. And so the best, essentially from their perspective, Manchuria provided the grounds from which they would presumably fight the Russians.
Right, fight Russia should that come to pass.
Yes.
Okay. And so at this point, because, I mean, looking back, some historians might see this as the start of Japan's expansionist policy, and we know where that ended up. But were there long-term ideas in Japan at this point about this is just going to be the start and then we're going to expand further and further?
Yes and no. There's a couple of ways we can think about that. I think maybe first it might be necessary to point out that actually up until the Manchurian incident, and certainly through the 1920s, Japanese policy had been one of kind of hands-off China. In other words, they made along with the Americans and the British, they decided they were not going to overtly support the warlords in China, that they weren't going to get themselves all tangled up in Chinese politics, and that any commercial competition in China between the Japanese, the Americans and the British would be purely that. It would be commercial and peaceful, as it were. And that worked very, very well through the 1920s. Then the Great Depression hit, and of course, world trade goes out the window. And at this point, in particular in the Japanese army, there was a very strong pushback against those policies of the 1920s. And so the soldiers, for one of I group them loosely, but the soldiers argued that the policies of the 1920s had really got Japan nowhere, that it was kind of like this wonderful, nice thought bubble, but once it popped, then Japan was left with nothing. And so from the army's perspective, it was much, much better, well, to actually have some real estate. And so this is more or less what these officers in the Kwantung Army are thinking when they set off that explosion in September 31. They're thinking to themselves, what we'll do is we'll cut this off from the rest of China and we'll make it some kind of independent state, but very much a part of the Japanese Empire.
Right. Okay. So this Kwantung Army, did they answer directly to Tokyo, or did they have a rather more independent street? I mean, was this dynamiting Tokyo's idea, or was it officers who decided to act on their own initiative?
That's a really good question, and it's fun to kind of think about, because yes, the Kwantung Army did answer to Tokyo, but yes, it did have a very, very independent streak. So these officers who set the explosion off kept Tokyo deliberately uninformed, or at least misinformed. And there were levels of misinformation and uninformation taking place. So, for example, they chose not to tell. They were very, very careful not to tell. There were two men in the army, effectively two men in the army, who reported directly to the emperor. And so they were very, very careful. And this is the army minister and the army chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very careful not to inform those men. They wanted it to be kept away from them so that they could not inform the emperor, so the emperor would not in any way try to stop what was taking place. But long story short, they kept Tokyo in the dark. They launched this explosion. They launched the invasion without actually telling Tokyo that this was their intention or plan. So then it got bigger because, of course, there were the Japanese army was also based in Korea. It was a Japanese colony. The commander in Korea sent his forces across the border into Manchuria, again, without informing Tokyo. So we're seeing it's a massive act of insubordination on the part of troops on the continent.
So why did the Kwantung Army's leaders decide to create an incident to use as a pretext instead? I mean, if they're going to be that independent, why don't they just say to Tokyo, hey, how about we just take over this area, let's go do it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think maybe the best way to think about that is that, I mean, we all have concepts of what comprises a just war.
Mm-hmm.
And although their actions were hardly add up to a just war, I guess in their own conception, if they created a reason for war, then this war would in fact be just.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, they're kind of conforming to, or in a weird kind of way, they're trying to make certain that whatever happens does conform to concepts of just war.
And I guess at this point, Japan's come out of World War One, where it was on the Allied side, and it very much spent the years afterwards part of a League of Nations trying to be a good model citizen, didn't it? So I guess at this point, it doesn't want to go out and do something that is blatantly unjust, as you say.
No. And certainly nobody in Tokyo thought this was a very good idea.
Right.
So even as the troops are running across Manchuria in, say, the latter part of September 31 and onwards, in fact, practically everyone in Tokyo is sending messages over to the continent and saying, stop, get back to your barracks,
right?
Stop this. And they're duly ignored. The most concrete action they took actually failed miserably. They sent a reasonably senior officer across to the continent to effectively impress on these, or partly to figure out what on earth was going on, but partly also to tell these guys, back to the barracks, that's enough. Unfortunately, when he got there, he ended up in, I guess, the Manchurian equivalent of a pub, and they proceeded to fill him with beer and rice wine, and by the end of the night, he was incoherent, and that was the end of his efforts at stopping what was taking place.
Oh, goodness me. So he didn't even try when he got sober the next morning. Just went, all right.
Probably he was kind of complicit in what was taking place anyway, so... Yeah.
Interesting. Our guest on This Week in History is Dr. Peter Moak, a senior lecturer in Asian history at the University of Western Sydney. We are looking at the Mukden incident, the 18th of September 1931, when a bit of dynamite was set off on this railway track in Manchuria that was controlled by Japan. And of course, as we're hearing, it was the Japanese who set that dynamite off themselves. So why did they choose the location that they did to place their dynamite on that night?
There was a Chinese garrison not too far away.
Right.
And so I guess it ties back to that, the narrative that they're trying to create. It made it easier to, in a way, for them to suggest that this had, in fact, been planted by Chinese soldiers.
Right. And I guess it's easy for them to go and attack the next morning if it's
also
that nearby
correct.
Well.
Yes.
All right. And they did that the next morning, didn't they?
Immediately. Almost immediately. They just launched operations. And all the operations had been planned down to the nth degree.
Now, the Chinese garrison chose initially not to resist the Japanese attack. So give us an idea of, well, why didn't they resist?
Essentially, they were operating on the principle that there's not a lot of point in fighting and on an individual basis dying when actually they had no hope of defeating the Kwantung Army. So the Japanese, this Kwantung Army was better trained, it was better armed, it was a modern army. It was a very, very powerful force. Numerically not enormous, but very, very strong, very modern, very strategically sound. It had all the makings of a very, very, very good force. The Chinese forces belonged to the Manchurian warlord, and they were not quite as, certainly they were not as modern, and they, although numerically vastly strong, bigger, they just couldn't hold a candle.
Because Zhang Xueling, who was the warlord there, and he's an interesting guy, his father had actually been killed by the Japanese not so many years previously.
Mm-hmm. A little earlier than the Manchurian incident, back, I think, in 1927, a group of, once again, in an act of subordination, a group of Japanese officers exploded yet another train. That one was carrying the warlord, the Manchurian warlord. They murdered him in the process with the idea that his son would replace him as warlord and that his son would prove more amenable to Japanese pressure and Japanese influence. A curious way of ingratiating yourself with someone by killing his father, but he didn't prove quite as amenable to their plans as they had hoped. Nonetheless, he certainly didn't want his forces, certainly in say, September, October 31, it just made no sense to send his forces into battle against Japanese forces and basically just sending them in to die.
And so what did that mean to not offer resistance? Did they just go, hey, you take the garrison, we'll be right? I mean, did they get killed? What actually played out?
Of course, Chinese there were casualties, of course. As I said before, the Japanese had actually planned this operation for months in advance, and so particularly when the Chinese were not offering so much in the way of resistance, it meant that the Kwantung Army fanned out across Manchuria in a very, very, very short space of time. It took them literally a couple of weeks, and they had the entire region under their control.
So they've just taken a whole Chinese region and after this incident, they're in control of the whole thing. Now, China, you've said, is a mess at this point. Mm-hmm. It couldn't have been too happy at watching this unfold in its north, though.
No, of course not. But again, there's only so much you can do. If a very, very, very powerful neighbour decides mm-hmm. that it's going to take a chunk of your territory and you don't have the means to stop that neighbour, then there's only... I guess the Chinese did... It's not as though they did quite nothing. They did go to the League of Nations and they did put their case to the League of Nations. Once the diplomats spoke... For example, the diplomats at the League of Nations spoke. Certainly, the American Secretary of State was quite loud in his denunciations of Japanese actions. But that kind of diplomatic language just had no impression on the Kwantung Army officers.
Okay. So they went to the international community, which did nothing to help. The League mm-hmm. of Nations did say, though, didn't it? Japan, you're in the wrong here. Like, get out of Manchuria.
Actually, the League of Nations sent a commission of inquiry right. over to Manchuria to see what was going on. And yes, they did. This commission did find the Japanese at fault. However, it was actually remarkably balanced in its appraisal of the situation in the area. So whilst the commission recommended that, for example, say Japanese troops go back to where they had been up until September 18, mm-hmm. they were nonetheless also quite critical of the Chinese and things that had been taking place. There were actually some in Japan, including the emperor himself, who, for example, the emperor was inclined to accept the commission's findings in their entirety. The problem was that the Japanese army had no intention of taking those findings in any way or form.
Okay. So is it this point that Japan decided to leave the League of Nations altogether?
More or less, yes. It took a little bit of time mm-hmm. and it also took a very, very bombastic young diplomat to go over to the League and make a really, really strange case. And he likened Japan in the 1930s to Jesus Christ on the cross, which I think left everybody in the League kind of scratching their head. He was very, very good. He had a mind that worked very, very quickly, but he, I think he left everybody kind of scratching their heads and wondering, not quite making they were unable to join the dots that he was creating for them.
Right. Okay. So Japan, though, when it decides to leave the League of Nations, I mean, obviously it sounds like getting out of Manchuria or going back to those lines of September 18 is unacceptable, but that decision, surely that was a real parting of the ways in which Japan said, we're not trying to be a good international citizen anymore. We're not trying to please Britain and America anymore. Was that the moment that Japan set off on the course that would lead to World War II?
Yes and no. It certainly did mark a parting of the ways, and it became, well, Japan launched, thereafter, it launched a career of aggression that ultimately wound up in World War II. I think it's easy, though, from our viewpoint. I mean, we all have 2020 vision in hindsight, mm-hmm. and so it's kind of easy for us to look back and say, oh, that happened in 1931, and then this happened, and then Japan went to war against China in July 37, and then it went to war against the US and the Brits in 41, etc., etc. And so it's easy for us to sort of see that as a nice, neat, straight line, but I think it's a bit of a mistake to think of things like that. So, in other words, in the aftermath of the Manchurian incident, it's not as though everything was set on a single course. There were choices that people made, and that there were possibilities at outcomes other than those which did eventuate. Maybe that's not a terribly satisfying answer, but
all right. So the Japanese government said, "All right, we've got Manchuria, we're staying there." And the Chinese, what happened there? Because they effectively made a puppet government in Manchuria, didn't they?
They created what the Japanese called the independent state of Manchuria. Others referred to it as a puppet state. In fact, they installed China's last emperor mm-hmm. from the Qing dynasty. They installed him as the emperor of this new state. There were idealists in Japan who did have quite astonishing visions of what Manchuria should become, and they saw it as this kind of a utopian place where there would be the various races, so I don't know, say Mongolian types and folks from Japan among others, and that they would all be cooperating and in this really utopian society. There were others who perhaps weren't quite as caught up in such thinking, and they were much more caught up in ideas about control and getting their hands on resources and using Manchuria strategically.
So in the longer story, then, of the history of Japan during the 1930s, how do you see the Manchurian incident?
That's an interesting question. It marks, I think we can say there's a couple of things about the Manchurian incident. So in the one instance, we can say that this point at which insubordination really starts to take hold within the Japanese army, there are numerous instances throughout the 1930s where army officers do similar things, maybe not on quite as big a scale as what happened over in Manchuria, but they do similar things through the 1930s where they, quite simply, they either ignore their superiors or they just go ahead and they do things, including launching a coup d'etat in February 36. So, and the Manchurian incident really marks that kind of a beginning point for this kind of breakdown in discipline within the army. So I think that in that sense, it's really significant. It's also significant in the sense that it really placed the Japanese army, if it weren't there already, it placed it in a very, very central position in Japanese politics, and it made it quite difficult for other bureaucracies and other branches of the Japanese government. It was sometimes difficult for them to get any kind of foothold with any kind of policies which perhaps didn't accord with what the army wanted. So therein lies another significance. And yeah, as you suggest, of course, it also marks that point at which, I mean, it certainly became very, very difficult for Japan after the Manchurian incident to re-establish a kind of a good relationship with some of its big neighbours, including, most importantly, probably the United States and the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. How did China see it? Because I've read that every September 18th in a number of locations across northeast China, the anniversary is marked with air raid sirens blaring for a couple of minutes. So the Chinese see this as a very important date in history, don't they?
Indeed, indeed. And in fact, I think you'll find there is a push within among Chinese scholars, for example, to regard the Manchurian incident as, in fact, the starting date of World War II. I'm not sure that terribly many people are on board with that, but it suggests that from the Chinese perspective that this is a very, very big event. And I think our listeners will perhaps be aware that contemporary Chinese-Japanese relations are not so great. And one of the key sticking points in that relationship is events dating directly back to World War II. So yeah, that's a really, really tricky one.
And so, well, between 1931, though, and then, of course, 1941, there's a lot that goes on in China and a lot of other things. The Rape of Nanking, obviously, which I think are probably still very much in that reasons why China would still be angry and resentful towards Japan. But that's another story.
Of course.
For another This Week in History. Dr. Peter Moak, Senior Lecturer in Asian History at the University of Western Sydney, thank you for talking us through the Manchurian incident and what it meant.
Great. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.